Mark Twain said, names are not always what they seem. Take that to the county auditor's office. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are now 2 months away from South Dakota's primary election. The deadline to register to vote is May 18th. Now, voters registering for the first time will need to bring proof of citizenship to the county auditor in order to register. And for some South Dakotans, that means a valid birth certificate. But not everyone's name matches the name on their birth certificate. Women who change their name after marriage and transgender South Dakotans who have legally changed their names may have to provide additional evidence of their identity, such as a marriage license. They're not the only people who are impacted by this. Sarah Lampert is an associate professor in the University of South Dakota History Department. I talked with her about the impact of Senate Bill 175, which is now in place, and legislation like the Save America Act, which is currently under consideration at the federal level, on everyday voters in South Dakota. Take a listen.
If you are a person who has a name change, if you are a married woman and 4 out of 5 married women legally change their name upon marriage, some women actually believe that it's required of them. It's actually incredibly difficult in many states for men to change their name upon marriage, right? So we have this administrative structure that really pushes women towards changing their name. We have an incredible set of social norms that push women into legally changing their name. And then you have anyone who has a name change for any other reason, including trans folks, your birth certificate is going to have a different name than your current legal documents. And so one of the big questions around these bills is, what other kinds of documentation are these individuals going to have to provide? Will it be accepted? But also just think about the kinds of additional legwork, right? Securing these documents, right? Securing originals of these documents. There's evidence that a number of people don't actually have original copies of their birth certificates, for example. And so you're placing all of this extra administrative responsibility on people with a legal name change just to prove their citizenship in order to register to vote, in person, which is another change. So that already makes it more difficult to register, period. You can't do mail-in registration, right? So if we look at all these different axes of identity, we're creating more and more barriers for people to register. And we're creating this greater burden of proof on people who are citizens, who under past registration requirements just have to state under threat of perjury that they're citizens, right? That's worked. The claim that there is widespread voter fraud or voting by people who are not citizens is largely unsubstantiated.
It takes resources to find the documents if you don't have them.
Well, I'll actually just put this very simply. I was having a conversation with a friend this weekend, and she's like, look, I read the text of these laws, and I don't know what to bring with me. Mm. I don't know what will count, right? I don't know what I need. I don't know if a photocopy is okay or if I need to bring my actual marriage certificate, right? And what she said to me, she's like, look, it is ridiculous that I have to carry around these original legal documents, let alone secure them, in order to register to vote. Right. And this is a person with resources who has the ability to go and register in person, who's able to take time off of work to do this. Right. Mm-hmm. And so she's pretty fired up and worried.
How could it impact transgender people?
One thing that I would point out is that transgender people are also being forced out of public life in other ways through state laws. So this actually exacerbates what's already a legal strategy to criminalize being a trans person in public life. So Kansas recently passed a law that basically if a transgender person's driver's license has a different gender marker than their sex assigned at birth on their birth certificates, then their driver's license is immediately invalidated. Mm-hmm. And so there are huge penalties for then driving with that license. And so you create all of this additional risk attached to just like being a person getting in your car, driving to work, or let alone using the bathroom, right? Because we have these bathroom bills. These kinds of restrictions requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote in person are building on top of what many trans people are experiencing, is a whole administrative apparatus that creates great risk to them to just be a person carrying out their everyday life.
And transgender people might be born in one state,
yeah,
move to another state, where they might have access to healthcare or housing and a community. That doesn't change your birth certificate. So then that changes your ability to vote, right?
I mean, well, and so think about it in terms of the ability to move across these invisible borders, that these imaginary borders that we create, right, between mm-hmm. states. And think about how one person's ability to just travel into another state might have a very different implication than another person, right? Mm-hmm. Something else to think about, and I kind of want to also go back to differences in state laws. I was looking up, you know, what are requirements to get a driver's license in, say, Minnesota versus South Dakota?
Sure.
In Minnesota, you don't have to actually show proof of citizenship, right? So we actually have a lot of variety at the state level in terms of what's required to obtain a driver's license, right? And to register to vote. And passing a blanket federal law that says that all people in order to vote in federal elections have to show proof of citizenship to register, I think is also experienced very differently based on where you live on a whole number of levels.
Yeah. Let's go back to the idea of why women change their names. Help us understand some of the history behind that. And then let's talk about women and getting the vote in the first place. But first, the name change. That goes back a long ways and it has legal implications.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most important concepts that I teach to all of the students in my history classes, and particularly in my women's history classes, is the legal principle of coverture. And this is a principle that came out of English common law that really governed women's lives and well into the 20th century. And I think its legacy is still with us in the societal pressure on women to change their names in marriage. So the principle of coverture is basically that women's legal identity is subsumed in their husbands upon marriage. So they lack any kind of legal identity outside of that marriage and are understood as they cannot hold property outside of their husband. They cannot sue or be sued, enter into a contract. It's also connected to an idea of a patriarchal marriage that rested on the idea of women's dependence, maintaining women's dependence on men and men's property ownership in women. And so this doctrine actually was one of the most significant and earliest focus of women's rights activists. Some of the early feminist writings, and I'm using the term feminist, even though that term only originates in the 1910s. I'm applying that to talk about people like Mary Wollstonecraft in England or Judith Sargent Murray in Massachusetts, who wrote passionately on what they called the equality of the sexes, and that they challenged the idea that women were inherently unequal to men. And they made this argument, and they were attacking women's subordination within marriage. Part of what's really significant is that when what we call the beginnings of like the first wave feminism, or the sort of first era of women's rights in the United States, that begins in the 1840s and is often linked to the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention in 1848, that call for women's rights was actually very focused on women's inequality within marriage, on women's lack of access to education, to ideas that women were moral authorities in the home, but but couldn't become ministers, right? They couldn't become authorities within their churches, that women could not hold own property outside of marriage, that it was incredibly difficult to obtain a divorce, and that when women sought divorce, it depended upon the state law and was tied to often to cause, they often lost their children because their children was also the property of their husbands. And so at that convention, one of the resolutions that was added on to this incredibly important document, a declaration of sentiments, included a call for women to gain the franchise. And that was actually the most controversial in some respects. And Frederick Douglass, who had liberated himself from slavery, who attended this convention, spoke up for the suffrage resolution. And he famously said, you know, right is of no sex, truth is of no color. But over the 1850s, as the women's rights movement starts to gain ground with annual conventions, state and national conventions, there's a whole range of concerns about the structures of women's subordination. And it's really with the Reconstruction Amendments that women's suffrage becomes a centerpiece of women's rights.
Do you think it's a step backwards? Are women's rights going backwards in the era that we're living in now?
Oh, completely. So I was thinking a lot about how to frame this for our conversation. And I'll give you a really important example. So as women started to organize at the local and the state and the national level for the right to vote in the second half of the 19th century, some women had actually lost the right to vote because in New Jersey, between 1776 and 1808, New Jersey's constitution did not restrict voting on the basis of sex. Many early state constitutions had property requirements. They also had racial requirements and gender, but New Jersey's didn't. And there is significant evidence that women in New Jersey voted in the early national period until state convention actually revised their constitution to link voting to male identity. And so I point this out because rights are not and rights gained are not inevitable into perpetuity, right? And if we look at the history of the long struggle for suffrage rights, we can see this ongoing push and pull and negotiation over the terms of suffrage that extends into the present moment.
Anything else that you think is really important for people to understand as we talk about voter identification laws right now?
There's so many things. One thing that I think is really interesting is that during the height of the women's suffrage movement in the second half of the 19th century, ideas about women's place within marriage were part of arguments both for and against women's suffrage. And I think that's really interesting. So women's suffrage activists increasingly made an argument that women's status as mothers and as moral guides within the family actually was a really crucial basis for them entering the public sphere fully and taking an active role as fully equal citizens along with men. And there were those who argued against women's suffrage who actually deployed these same ideas. They argued that suffrage was a burden, that women didn't want this privilege, that actually participating in politics was going to compromise their womanhood. Now, a lot of this is also tied to ideas about white womanhood, and there's this whole intersecting history about racism that we can also talk about. But why I bring that up is that so often in American history, are arguments about what reforms protect and determine sort of full citizenship are often discussed very differently for women based upon gendered ideas about what their social role should be. Mm-hmm. So in a moment in which we see this really intense elevation of ideals about quote unquote traditional marriage, right? I think these things are culturally connected, and that concerns me.
What kinds of actions are you seeing women take? Are there things that you think are effective ways for women to take action for women's rights in 2026?
I think we look to the past, and I think we need to pay attention. I think we need to connect with people in our communities, writing and calling your representatives, and being a kind of consistent voice in their ear about what you feel about their actions as your representative is always really, really important. I think people need to check their voter registration. Everyone needs to check your voter registration. I would say check it like every few months. When you stay informed and you stay involved and you speak up, you figure out also who your allies are and who are the people you can lean on to strategize, to go with you to register, to go with you to vote, to make sure that when you exercise your franchise, that that is also not being challenged in ways that violate your constitutional right to vote.
Sarah Lampert is an associate professor in the University of South Dakota History Department. She joined me from SDPP Studios in Vermilion. For questions about registering to vote, please contact your county auditor. People who are already registered to vote, by the way, are not impacted by the new voter registration laws in South Dakota. Proceed as normal. That's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.